Now more than ever, Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price, you want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's, we help, you save. Price match applies to same item, current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at lowes.com/lowestpriceguarantee.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I'm creating a tribe of tech entrepreneurs that are on a mission to do something big and meaningful. I invite you to join the tribe as well, especially if you want to create change that matters and put your software business on momentum that you're proud of. The goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest on my podcast today is Arnoud Henneville-Wetholm, author of How Hard Can It Be?
People have a lot of ideas. Yeah. Constantly, I guess that's what we do as human. We have plenty of ideas, but ideas are cheap. What matters is execution. And unless you execute, and how long can you execute once you've decided that you are someone who indeed executes? You know, how long can you go? How far can you go? People start companies, but they all drop. You know, along the way, people drop, and they stand on that shelf as a souvenir of, you know, what, you know, startups that tried and did not go all the way through.
This is Arnoud. He's a consultant, lecturer, and head of sales and business development at Globee. He's also the founder of multiple startups, including Internal Desk, a SaaS platform for enterprise collaboration, where he serves as a COO. He's passionate about entrepreneurship, neuroscience, resilience, and making the world a better place. He works on projects that he believes in with people that go for it. He finishes everything he starts. He trains like there is no tomorrow, and he enjoys the now and looks forward to the journey. He goes by the mantra, get comfortable being uncomfortable. And that is no understatement. In his book, How Hard Can It Be?, he explained his personal journey in building up a startup that got founded around the big idea to take down Facebook. The book is a jet-setting parable of the European startup scene that takes on the most elusive business topics of them all, failure. And that inspired me, and hence I invited Arnoud to my podcast. We explore the journey that he and his team went through with their startup, the pivots that were required, and the commercial, financial, and emotional challenges that this brought along. We pinpoint the critical ingredients to getting right from a solution perspective to create virality, stickiness, and growth that's sustainable. Last but not least, he addresses what to be prepared for as a founder and how and why to embrace failure as a hidden gem. By listening to this podcast, you'll learn four things. Firstly, that having a product that is functionally rich and technically scalable is only half the battle. Business model scalability, that's the other one. Secondly, that the best thing you can do for your company is to demonstrate persistence in sticking to the one thing that you're after. Don't pivot too early. Thirdly, that a ground principle of creating something remarkable is to focus on doing something utterly different and not just better. And fourthly, why you need to be persistent in finding problems that are mission critical, not just nice to have. Well, hi, Arnoud. Thank you for making the time available today and share the story of the startup. But it's a startup, but all the pivots that you've been doing from it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you. So I look forward to this conversation.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to it as well. And people that are trying to get a guess what this is all about. This is about a book. It's called How Hard Can It Be? And it's about a software startup and the journey of failure and getting up and failure and falling back and getting up and et cetera. It's full of really, really valuable anecdotes. And I loved reading the book. Actually, now that I got you on the podcast, I know that I think that I know you already much better than I do any of my guests, but let's get going through this. So your book is about really putting on paper what it's like to try and create something super meaningful, but not succeeding with it after 5 or 6 years in total.
Yes, indeed. Six years, a little bit over 6 years, actually, from the ideation and coming up with the concept to actually shutting it down over 6 years.
It's brave in itself. You know, I mean, I know not a lot of entrepreneurs say failure is something that we see as a gift and failure is something that we applaud for because we can learn from it. But there's not a lot of people that put it on paper because their company just didn't succeed.
Exactly. And that's precisely why I chose to write this. And it's not that it wasn't easy, because I'm very comfortable with it. And we can go through why. But that's the real purpose. I've been in entrepreneur settings, entrepreneurship settings and startups for some time now. And it appears that most journeys, although they are unique, they are very similar. I mean, you have to do sort of the same thing when you start up a company, from coming up with an idea to creating a team to having a bigger purpose than yourself to designing that product and coding it and making it happen and getting your first customer and raising money. And I mean, the journey in itself is similar, regardless of what you sell, regardless of the market you're after, of the industry in which you operate. It's the same stuff. The learnings of what may happen during that journey, I think, are very, you can leverage them for your own journey. And that's why I chose to write the book. It's because this is the book I would love to have read prior to me starting. It would have given me a big head start.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, the statistics are still so overwhelming if you look at it. It's like between 70 and 90% of startups will fail, they say.
Totally. So I went through the stats. These are the numbers. I mean, 9 out of 10 will fail. And so my take on this was, well, we're being pitched success. I mean, everywhere you look at, you see success, whether it's your Instagram feed or billboard, you are always sold success. And I get it. It's way more sexy than selling you failure. But we, at the same time, we all recognize that it's in the deeps that we learn. I mean, we learn from adversity. We learn from being able to get up when we've been flat out. So my take is, well, if the stats are what they are, 9 out of 10 actually fail, by being shown constant stories of success, maybe the answer is not in showing success, but rather in showing failures, or at least in showing lessons from failures. And I thought, I looked around, I couldn't find that book. So I thought, I'm going to write this, because again, those journeys are very similar. And with that book, hopefully you can get yourself up to speed faster and get to your success that you deserve way faster than I've been able to do that.
Yeah, interesting. And thumbs up for doing this. But let's sort of like wind back the whole thing, because in the book, you go through various phases. It's like three big pivots. Uh-huh. First, trying to kind of go big in a B2C market, then pivoting to B2B, and then pivoting another time to another flavor of B2B. Whereby the funny thing is that in the first version, you tried to really attack Facebook.
Right.
And in the other version, you were being attacked by Facebook. But just to kind of start on that, and I want to understand like what was the big idea behind your company, because when you, for example, when I read the first chapter, you really described the situation of launching that first version, and it goes live after waiting for hours and hours for people to fix that last type of bugs, and then you see the numbers go up, and you do 45 users per minute, and then you get journalists writing about it, and they're positioning you as the next big thing.
Right.
Like, what was this about?
Yeah, so the idea initially is to take down Facebook, hence the title, lessons learned from trying but failing to take down Facebook. And the big idea was that, so my co-founder and I were working in change management. We're a consultant here in Stockholm, in Sweden, doing change. And we, as behavioral specialists, we could not understand why people would spend their time on Facebook scrolling through kilometers of nonsense. We couldn't understand this. Why would someone do that? And what was the whole pleasure of doing that? And, you know, what would people take away from this? Yeah. So we're getting frustrated as per the, you know, the behavioral aspect of it. And we thought that, okay, is the world going dumber, or do we need to do something about this? And we thought we had the, you know, the stamina, the energy, the passion to try to fix it. So we thought that instead of engaging, quote unquote, people by means of likes, we would create a platform that would try to engage people in the real world. So let's go back to do some things for real. Like, yeah, if you commit yourself to do something with your time instead of just sitting in a sofa and pressing a like button. So that was the core idea. How can we get people off, you know, out of their couches, back into the real world? And the mechanism to do that was a challenge. So we would challenge people to do something, and they would challenge themselves to do something, most likely something that always wanted to do, like, you know, start running or lose weight or grow a mustache for November or whatever the case may be. And the challenge mechanism would allow the viral effect. So we would have built into the model, built into the platform, a way of getting users for free, because I would challenge a couple of my friends, they would challenge their friends and so forth. So quickly we could exponentially grow. And that's kind of what happened. So people joined, they sign up, they started creating challenges for themselves and towards others. But then what we learned is that it didn't really go to the plan.
Yeah, I mean, I saw that. I mean, it's like, and I really like that phrase that you used in the book. You were going to create the anti-couch potato network. it's indeed, you see that it started, and you have the impressive numbers of 45 users per minute, and that's kept going and going and going. But then you really hit a couple of pretty interesting challenges that you possibly couldn't even foresee. You know, it's maybe in the scale of the platform itself, like because of all the things that people are sharing. I really like that example that you had in there, that there were some really unethical challenges being put up by giving people a challenge to be in a lion's cage.
Right.
Yeah. And if you see that develop, what does that do to you? And I mean, how do you, we're talking about agile and being flexible as a startup. Uh-huh. How do you go about it?
Yeah, when we started to see those challenges, that was rough, because on the one hand, you can say that, you know, all publicity is good publicity, that no matter what happens, you know, people will talk about us, and we've got some guys in a zoo trying to do some stupid things. So sort of a jackass kind of challenges. Exactly. But as you start digging, and this has to happen really quick, because we don't have the luxury of time to allow that challenge to be live and you know, things bad to happen. So we have to make quick decisions and start looking at the, you know, the legal aspect of it and the potential lawsuit that we could get if someone would be injured or, you know, killed. Or, and of course, we don't want to be associated with that. So suddenly we have, you know, the lawyers and drafting documents to sort of protect the company and us personally in case of something going really south. So that was a scary moment for sure, but we somehow navigated it, yeah, properly, I think, and sort of cleared those challenges before they would go live.
Exactly. I mean, the book is full of examples of all the things that you then suddenly see that are happening that you couldn't even believe happening. One of the things, of course, that's a big thing for startups. You were part of a change management consultancy company. Then you decide, okay, let's do this in our free time. And at some point, we're just going to cut it and do it. But then, of course, other aspects come in, like runway and funding. I really like that whole story of like trying to become part of one of the most prestigious VCs out there, this thing you talk about. What did you learn from that process? Because these guys are like, it's almost like building a waiting list there.
Oh, yeah, totally. So this is, I mean, today, actually, a couple of weeks ago, they've won the most successful tech incubator in the world. So I'm not sure of the criteria, but they've gotten some really nice recognition. Yeah. So it's equivalent to the Y Combinator out there. So we wanted to get there because we thought that would be like a stamp of quality of, I mean, you always look for external affirmation.
Sure.
So we thought that this would help us, you know, get angel money, start to get funding, and we needed coaching, you know, we had not done that before. So we would take any assistance we could get along the way and the network that goes with it. And so the first time we pitched, we were actually refused because, well, we didn't have a tech background and we were trying to, you know, aim at Facebook, which is a rough one. And we didn't have a team that was, you know, competent to doing that. So in spite of all of our, you know, nice on paper experiences prior, there was no reason for Sting to accept us in that we didn't really fit the mold of tech entrepreneurs. So we got a no. So we had to go back after a few times, find ways to actually make it happen, create a team, develop a prototype, launch, get some traction. And after getting some traction, then we qualified as, well, obviously those guys are driven enough to be part of this clique of, you know, exceptional entrepreneurs. And so we got in.
Yeah. So what was the hardest part in that whole process?
Well, you know, of course, when you, again, because you want that external affirmation, the moment the door, you know, is slammed in your face, it's easy to believe that, well, perhaps this is not something for you to do. Maybe you should go back to what you do best, which is consulting. And I think you can copy paste that thinking throughout the journey. You know, you are going to get a lot of doors in your face constantly. You're going to fall and fall and fall over. But if you are only looking for outside confirmation, you are going to be wanting to quit very often. So, you know, the beginning is really, you know, we had barely started at that point. So that was a nice, that was a nice wake-up call. And we saw it again over and over throughout the journey. So we learned right off the bat that, hey, this is not as simple as it looked like. It's not that you enter an incubator and you are coached and you raise money and life is well and you end up being acquired. No.
At the end, you know, they do that for a reason. They want to bet their, well, they're going for quality and they want to pre-assure from the start that this is something that will make it at the end. It will be part of the 10%.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, they edge their bets, right? So like a VC or like you buying stocks, you know, spreading your eggs into your portfolio, you want to make sure that you have companies that, you know, in different segments, in different industries and placing strategic bets. Yeah. And in the end, still, even though you get, you know, la crème de la crème, as we say in French, we still end up with 9 out of 10 failing. So, I mean, the ratio is quite, yeah, it's what it is.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I remember the story and how did it typically unfold where you got introduced to some people and they were talking about their wall with a lot of, what is it, crying babies on the wall? I'm not sure what the word was.
Yeah.
No, it was babies without parents.
Exactly. So that's the image. It's a very nice metaphor for, you know, the kind of, a lot of people have a lot of ideas constantly. I guess that's what we do as human. We have plenty of ideas, but ideas are cheap. What matters is execution. And unless you execute, and how long can you execute once you've decided that you are someone who indeed executes? Yeah. You know, how long can you go? How far can you go? And that's why in this basement of crying babies sitting on the wall, the image is really that, you know, plenty of youngsters or, you know, whatever kind of people start companies, but they all drop, you know, along the way, people drop, and they stand on that shelf as a souvenir of, you know, what, you know, startups that tried and did not go all the way through.
Exactly. So you made it through the Sting. They had incredible belief in you and you were in the magazines. There was a lot of good promotion on it. You had this big hockey stick at the beginning where people just kept signing up. I mean, as you say in the book, the vision drove the signups, but then people started to abandon because of fear.
Yes.
So that's a fantastic idea. Nobody wanted to complete it.
Exactly. And that's, you know, human behavior in a nutshell. It is hard to... So first of all, it is hard to do something that you haven't done before, that you've never done, and that you don't know if you are going to be able to do.
That's for the user perspective, right? It's like the people that actually use your platform to do those challenges.
Exactly. It is very hard. And it is even harder when it's in front of the world. Because if you haven't done it before, Now you're committing, you know, there's this well-known fact that if you commit and if you declare your ambitions, then you're going to have this external pressure, which will help you achieve that goal of yours. At the same time, it can be tricky because, you know, how much confidence do you have in yourself and self-confidence to put that out and fail potentially in front of the eyes of the entire world? And so what we saw is that whilst people were signing up and, you know, challenging themselves to, you know, lose weight, start running, stop smoking or whatnot, they would not complete it. They would find all sorts of excuses as to not to do it. You know, they got sick, the kids got sick, they got to travel, not anymore, but they got to travel for work, they were busy on other things, and the project just dies off slowly and slowly. And that's very much life in a nutshell. You set yourself a goal, you're very eager in the beginning, you push hard, and you know, you may resist a few doors, but then eventually you start wondering whether that thing is actually meant for you, and you give up. And that's people, that's life.
Yeah, even with signing up celebrities to kind of help people a little bit, to inspire them even more, it just died out. And you started to realize why Facebook at the end was so popular, because it is about couch.
Exactly, because it's easy. It's way easy. Easier to, you know, if you, yeah, it's way easier to sit in front of TV and sort of share what you've been eating last night and, you know, the party you are going to go to next week and that kind of stuff, instead of, go out, it's minus 10, but put your shoes on and go running.
Yeah.
That's rougher.
So then you had to realize you had to pivot. So let me see. This was about going to the corporate world. Around the same type of thing, right? So the challenge, but then kind of apply to businesses. Tell a little bit about like how the pivot of that vision and what that did to you.
Yeah, it became quite obvious actually, because so at that point when we realized that it is a behavioral question, we have built that platform for challenges, and since we come from, you know, change management, the obvious thing to do is to call a few former clients that we had then and ask them, would they not challenge their staff with a challenge platform? Yeah. And of course, the answer is yes, because it makes total sense in a corporate setting. So, you know, a few calls, boom, and we were signing contracts and having companies, you know, signing up for challenging their staff to, you know, increase sales, lower inventory, demonstrate core value understanding, align around the next strategic rollout initiative. So it did work very nicely. And this time it came top down. So instead of you having to involve yourself into something that is uncomfortable, you would have your boss challenging you to do something that you have to do. So the top down effect made it more of something that you would do as an employee. So it was easier in many ways.
Yeah. But still, because it didn't turn out as you'd hoped it to be. But one of the things that, what is it? I mean, the vision was, I mean, I like the word, to rejuvenate consulting industry and to do something different there that actually made you competitor to your old company, which was another thing because you had investors from that company and suddenly you became a competitor. But still, it didn't hold through because at some point in the book, you say it sort of flattened out. And then people that were your ambassadors started to leave. So what was that thing? Was it the same type of human type thinking that killed it again?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, what we set ourselves to do then, I mean, the next iteration of the vision was that we would make change cool. You know, we would make change something that doesn't need to be force-fed to employees, but something that employees would voluntarily, you know, engage in because they would have a reason to do it. I mean, typically, you know, if you ask people to do something, they're very reluctant to do it. I mean, it needs to come from themselves. So the idea was that as we bring in employees into the process of change in an organization, they would more happily commit to initiative. And as a result, we would get more traction inside an organization when it comes to that initiative actually being executed as it should be. That worked well. What didn't work, though, is that this is very much a project-driven sort of company. We have that project, we have that client, there is a start to the project and an end to the execution of the project. And so to get that project would take too much time. And once we would get that project after this long sales cycle, because we're selling to large organizations, we'd had to execute it because, of course, the client would have paid quite some substantial money to make that happen. And when you sell something expensive, as you know, you want to be, you know, taking care of your client. You don't want to be, you know, it's not a software, click a button and be happy with it. So we would do a lot of customization. We would do a lot of customer relation and, you know, being really consultative in the approach. And that naturally was not the way to scale. There was a, you know, built-in limit to that. So we could get clients, we could get projects, but it was really not what we wanted to be achieving. We wanted clients like ahead of, let's say, HR or ahead of sales, being constantly using challenges as a way to drive, you know, the behaviors that they were seeking to have in their teams. But that didn't turn to be the case because of the so-called challenge fatigue.
You know? Yeah, you actually talk about challenges around maladdiction, where executives are leaving and they're working for big companies where there's a lot at stake. There's a lot to lose for them. And as a consequence, it's easy to do something, again, it's easier to do something easy and not that risky.
Right.
It's the same problem again as with consumers.
Well, totally. I mean, it's always, you know, when you compete in B2B, and that applies across startup trying to get into the B2B business, is that when you are small and you don't have a lot of backup and you start having to deal with IT, security, legal, auditing, and be, you know, within the framework of that client organization. So first of all, it is not only very labor intensive for a small company, but it is also very risky for the project manager, for the leader who wants to take you on board, because the alternative to you is a well-established company, a Microsoft or an IBM. And as we know, no manager gets fired for buying Microsoft, whereas they may do from buying from a small startup that may not have all So it's tricky to sell yourself in when you are small, but I guess we all start small.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing in the book. You talk about like the difference between creating traction and having scalability and sort of the balance that you always try to create, because it's in my book, I write about it as well. Remarkable software companies master the art of creating momentum.
Right.
But with momentum comes indeed like the thinking about, is this scalable technology-wise, deployment-wise? So what did go wrong in that particular aspect?
Well, so yeah, traction versus scalability. It's, you know, you can have a product that you can scale, but the business model may not be sustainable. That's really where we ended. Everything looked perfect. I mean, we had the capacity to host many companies. We had the tech aspect of it was working nicely, but the model in itself was not. And for it to become sustainable, we would have to move away from a sort of a consultative sale type of approach to a product-based approach with a per-user license or something like that, which is yet another complexity into the sales process, because they're not, the buyer is not used to the way that you want to have for your product to scale. So, you know, it's tricky.
Let me make a small interruption here. Arnold just made a critical remark about what it takes to succeed as a business software company. It's not enough to just build a good scalable product. It's not enough to solve a valuable problem. No, it's also critical to ensure the business model is sustainable and fit for scale. That starts with addressing a mission critical problem. And getting this mix right is a trait that remarkable software companies master. They start by ensuring three key questions are answered with a firm yes. Firstly, is the problem that we solve valuable in the eyes of the ideal customer? Secondly, is it critical on their agenda? And thirdly, can we exceed their expectations? If one of them is no, start over. And this is where the difference is made between creating something that's addressing a nice-to-have problem versus something that's mission critical. You can master these traits as well. I have various options for you to start. Just go to valueinspiration.com to learn about the masterminds and the work streams to put the fundamental building blocks in place to fast track the growth of your software company. And as you're there anyway, don't forget to grab a free Kindle version of my book The Remarkable Effect to start sparking new inspirations in the next 30 minutes. Back to the interview. So what did you learn from that? Because you did talk about a value-based pricing concept.
Yes.
Was that the killer of scalability?
Yeah, probably. Because the moment you start selling value, you need to put man hours, in my view. That goes away from it's a bit away from the type product sales type model. So we were sort of an hybrid where we would sell value, we'd try to sell value with a product, having a tech platform and having consultants. So it was very, very tricky to navigate. And that's where
that's a critical decision to make. I mean, are you selling services powered by software, or are you selling software whereby services are there to just ensure it ends up running?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And that, I guess, I think you need to try different iteration and see what works best. And after trying for, a few years, we were not successful to the extent that we had envisioned. And that's where we decided to do a third massive pivot.
Exactly. Yeah, true. Because I mean, the way you write it, you can almost feel the pressure, like 4 months runway, 4 months, 3 months runway. You can almost touch the end. And every time is that another round again to try to convince funders, investors. And for this particular one, where you really wanted to go and kind of pivot again, you went back to one of your old investors and they said no.
So at the very end, exactly. So we did another pivot in between. We expanded because we realized that our model was not scalable. We expanded into a sort of a internal. So we added features. So instead of being product niched, challenge based, we moved away from that and slowly developed the platform to an extent that it would become an internal social platform. So we, it was quite interesting because that was prior to the social, the ESN, as it is called, like enterprise social networks. So that was in the very beginning of that era. And the only way we had found to pitch that value proposition was to say that, think of it as Facebook, but internally, we are your internal Facebook. And in that way, people could understand what we were after. So we were that, central communication for all departments of the organization to have a social feed and be able to share and discuss basically what you know today as being workplace. And after struggling and getting some clients again, we went all that circus again, Facebook announced that they were going live with Workplace. Yeah. And hence, to piggyback on your first line, which is from Facebook to Facebook. So that's the whole storyline of the book, is that we started to go after Facebook into B2C. And then eventually it caught up with us and we got killed by Facebook at work. Coming after us after we had started that niche.
Yeah. It's a fascinating story. And I mean, everything in between, all the details there. Yeah. Make you think and make you reflect about, are we on the same path at the end if you're running a startup at the end? What I'm always trying to kind of figure out is for each of those companies that you were, because there were three companies at the end.
Yes.
Or three versions of companies. Was the problem that you were solving clear enough? Or maybe it's turning it out. Was it more was the thing that you were trying to solve more a nice to have? Or mission critical?
Yes, that's a very good question. Yeah, I mean, the last thing you want to do is a nice to have. You need to find a way to be a mission critical product or service. Or I think that's the battle for every startup, is to become that thing that everyone uses, not just once, because that's no traction, but over and over. You need to have stickiness, as it is called.
Yeah, true.
Right. So, yeah, I write about this in the book. You can ask the question to yourself whether you actually know what you are doing. If you look at yourself in the mirror and you can ask the question, are we really knowing what we are about? And maybe there's no answer to that, because that thing keeps evolving based on the customer feedback, based on the environment feedback that you are getting over and over. It's really about the process of understanding who you are and the value that you can deliver. And hopefully, eventually, that, you know, all that feedback, all that knowledge that you acquire along the way gets you to a place where it matches both your competencies, the competencies of the team, the vision that you may have, and what the market is after. And that's where the magic potentially happens. But as we know, it happens for very few of us, 1 out of 10.
Exactly. So if you look at all the things that happened, six, seven years in a row,
yes,
what has been the hardest thing in that whole journey? The hardest nut to crack?
Yeah, I think it's the ultimately what is left is this, the belief in yourself. Do you have enough in the tank to keep going? And that, I think, is at the core of what the entrepreneur journey is about, because there are so many reasons for you to give up every day. And so unless you are really animated by what you are doing and you really believe in what you're, that you are solving a key problem, and that you, no matter what happens, you keep going at it. And even if you have to change direction and perhaps to 180 degree change, you still are able to gather enough passion around that new vision that you create that you keep going. And that is very hard, because obviously, as a self-reflection, and I touch upon this in the book, it's sadly, it's not just about you. It's about not only everyone that is involved in that thing, I mean, directly, like your team and whatever is going on their personal sides, but also everyone that you have collected along the way, your investors, your supporters, your family, most importantly, right? What happens around creates so much pressure that it gives you further reasons to not continue. And so I think it really takes courage and really self-belief that you are here for a reason and you will achieve that. And as it turns out, again, you may not. And that's okay. So that's the kicker in the at the end of the book, is that, well, you know, whether you succeed or not, it's not really the point. The point is you should enjoy the journey as opposed to, you know, just going after the destination and the reward.
Very true.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, have you got any, I mean, how do you, well, you talk about a couple of very important things like belief, courage, because at the end, you're responsible for so many people in that whole network around you. What is then fundamental thing that you keep coming back to that you say, okay, this, it's worth it?
Yeah.
What do you need to have in place in order to have to be so strong in there?
Yeah. I think now I think I've nailed it to one thing, is, or a couple of things, but one would be resilience. You know, so self-belief, resilience. Yeah, you have to have it. You have to. And, you know, I didn't have it when we started. I mean, to some extent, because I wanted to be an entrepreneur and I had started a few things before. I mean, it's not that I woke up one day and decided to go attack Facebook. I was, you know, very entrepreneurial in my ways. But yeah, maybe it's built in. I don't know. You develop it. You certainly further develop that resilience as you get hit by adversity. And so what is left in the end is really follow something that you are truly passionate about. And you often hear this thing that, well, I have to first find my passion and then I will go after it. And what I've learned is that, no, you go after something that you believe you are, or that you are passionate about today. But make no mistake, that passion will probably change over time, right? You get passionate about other things, and that's okay. Yeah. And you need to constantly go after that new passion, and that what keeps you going forward is this idea that, yeah, I'm doing something that I'm happy about, I feel good about, and that keeps me waking up. And I think in the end, that's what is left, you know? You don't want to die, or you don't want to be, you know, 19 years old, and regretting not having done the thing that you were then passionate about. So it's not about really, you know, making it big or whatever the outcome in terms of financials may be, or it's really about, I've got this burning desire to do this because at the core, this is me. Hence, I'm going to go after it, because if I don't, I will regret not having done it for whatever few years I have left when I'm looking back at my life. So that's really where I am today. Do the things that you really want to do, which is why I decided to also, it's part of the reason why I wrote the book. You know, it would be utterly stupid for me to leave all that knowledge on the table and, you know, don't have anyone being able to leverage it. So that's my, you know, sort of a giveaway.
True. Yeah, exactly. That's for sure. If you look back at the whole journey, if you'd known all of this before.
Yes.
You read the book of someone that's called Arnau.
Yes.
And you're at the point that you want to start something. What would you do different today than you did? Well, that's not, maybe that's like kind of going to be a lot. But what would be the one thing that you say, okay, but this is what I would definitely do different?
Yeah. So first, if I had read that book, I would have gained, you know, so many years of, you know, knowledge. Yeah. So I would be richer going in. So I wouldn't have to think, you know, things that I've been thinking along the way. But I think one thing I should have probably done, we should have done as a team, is stick to the one thing we were after initially. And that one thing may not have been the first iteration where we went after Facebook, but probably the second, because as I look at it today, it's not that I've spent a lot of time digging into whether that application that we're trying to be exists today. So if it's not, and if one of your listeners is going after that, go for it, because I think there's a market there. But I think we should have stuck to that and persevere to prove the case. Maybe we would have fallen before we did and didn't raise, you know, more rounds, but at least we would have gone to the very end, and perhaps we would have created a business that would have been somewhat scalable, maybe not as much as we would have wanted, but at least we could have made a good living out of this. But again, the question is back to the, what is it you want to do? And our vision was to create a platform that would scale, and not being a bunch of consultants with a tech tool in the backpack. And that's where we chose not to do it. So it really depended on, I think, what you want to do as a person and as a team.
Yeah, I think indeed, if I read the book, I've read the book, if I look at it again, the vision between the B2C, B2B was still sort of the same. It was about challenges and kind of setting people up for bigger success. And in the third iteration, it weakened.
Yes.
And it was also driven by a customer that has done the challenges, but wanted to something else, and kind of getting that contract to solve your 3 months runway. And that's, of course, that is something that I see a lot with B2B software companies, that they become short-term driven and then end up with a contract where they sell themselves a story. Yeah, but the customer is paying for this and we can sell this too.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah, it's painful. It's painful. But yeah, it's reality. And so thanks for putting it on paper. Like, I wrote my book, The Remarkable Effects, just put them together now, kind of blending like your knowledge with the topic of that book. Having been an entrepreneur, having gone through all the hoops and loops, what do you believe are key traits that a company needs to have in order to create software that people just keep talking about?
Yes, yeah, something remarkable. I love the Seth Godin definition of being remarkable is being worth making a remark about.
Exactly.
And so to do that, you need to do something utterly different. And we all want to find similarities, again, for, I guess, external affirmation, confirmation of what we are doing is actually existing in the market. But I think that if you do something that is totally new, I mean, totally new, which is a hard thing to do, obviously, but you're setting yourself for more success because you are inventing something totally new, and then you're passionate about, and people are wowed. You create that wow factor. But to be another Me Too product with a little feature on the side, a little, you know, price differentiator, a little something that is not worth the change, because at the end of the day, I mean, if you have, right, if you have a tool that is already set into your Chrome or set into your Microsoft Office, what's the likelihood of replacing that thing that is already being used by millions of people?
Yeah.
Very, very non-likely, unlikely. So in order to do that, you really need to do something that is unique. And that's a tough one.
Yeah, it is a tough one. I call it a habit. You know, it's something that you just ingrain in your culture and start looking for it and challenging yourself around that particular thing. Good point. I like the way you put it there. Let me see one more question. Yeah, I mean, if you had to kind of give one do and possibly one don't to CEOs out there that aspire to create something remarkable as well, what would it be based on what you've learned so far?
So to CEO of you mean established company or like younger?
Could be an established company that want to step up and do something radically different again.
Yeah.
Or startup entrepreneurs in themselves.
Yeah. Good question. I think for CEOs, when you put that, I very much like the discussion around innovation in large organizations, because this is something I've been working with and trying to crack for some years. And every organization wants to bring in the entrepreneur mindset, this idea of, you know, battling and trying hard and fighting and being agile and having all those ideas and, you know, yeah, working agile as a team and so forth. But no one is really keen to have the conversation around failure. And I think you can't have innovation if you don't have failure. That sounds obvious. But if as an enterprise, you don't have a culture that supports, you know, the discussion around failure, which means that in practice, a leader should allow failure and use it as a, you know, template or springboard for that discussion to improve on the next iteration. So unless you have that willingness in leadership, which obviously if it comes from your leader, it needs to be cascaded throughout the organization. So unless you have both, yes, we go for innovation, but at the same time, we recognize that failure is important. Well, you are not going to develop anything new and fresh. You're just going to be dying over time because you are unwilling to accept that it does take a lot of trials and errors and failure to produce something meaningful and something remarkable. So my take would be, let's learn from startups, let's learn from failure and have that conversation, because there's really hidden gems in the, you know, the knowledge acquired by all the guys like me who've tried and failed. And those guys should be consulted to large organizations, I think.
Well said. I think these are nice words to round it off with, because I completely agree with this. And it's I think it sums up everything you said in the book. So where can people go to find your book? How hard can it be?
Yeah.
And where can people go to connect to you and get you leveled up for a keynote or
absolutely
consulting?
Yeah. So the book luckily is not as hard to find. So it's available everywhere, you know, every major platform, Amazon, locally, you know, across markets, really. I've been really happy and had the luxury of being endorsed by some serious authors and professors and serial entrepreneurs. So it's something I'm very proud of. It's available everywhere. Otherwise, on my book site, howhardcanitbethebook.com. As for me, I'm, you know, happy to connect on LinkedIn, which is the platform I use the most, not Facebook, but LinkedIn. And yeah, look forward to be in touch with as many entrepreneurs as possible and leaders in organization, and hopefully bring that discussion of failure, you know, to the surface. And in doing so, trying to turn around the success to rate failure of startup tomorrow going forward.
Thank you. And this ends my conversation with Arnoud. I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Arnoud Hennefield Wedholm, author of How Hard Can It Be? As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at don.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas. And that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.